for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama ordered new rules to make it easier for gays and lesbians to make medical decisions on behalf of their partners. Arizona Governor Brewer is expected to sign what would be the nation's strictest law in dealing with illegal immigrants. And Congress passed legislation to restore unemployment benefits to jobless Americans. Joining me in the studio for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, Linda Wertheimer of NPR, Byron York of The Washington Examiner. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning,
good morning,
Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Linda, I haven't seen you for such a long time. It's good to have you with
you.
Us.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what the president's decision to extend hospital visitation rights to partners of gays and lesbians. Why did he decide to do that now, Byron?
Well, yeah, a lot of the president's gay and lesbian supporters have felt that he has not moved quickly enough on some of their agenda items. This is something the president can do. It has to do with the federal government's power over hospitals that accept Medicare and Medicaid patients, which is almost all of them, and say, look, you cannot restrict visitation from someone on the basis of it's their gay partner. So this is something the president can do pretty much with the stroke of the pen. He did it through his HHS secretary. I will say one more thing about it. And in the debate over gay marriage, this is sometimes cited as a factor. And opponents of gay marriage said, look, we don't want to keep people from being able to visit their partner in the hospital. There must be other ways in redefining marriage to do it. And here the president has done it in one easy move.
EJ.
Yeah, I think that last point is exactly right, that this is the right thing to do, and it's politically smart, because in all of the polling about gay marriage, what you find is majorities of Americans favor giving gay couples virtually all the rights that are given to married couples. There are just a lot of people who hold back at the word marriage. That number is declining, but it's still a majority out there. So what the president does here is he gives gays and lesbians something they very much want, which is the right to help their partners when they are in the hospital, visit them, have some control over their health care, without offending anyone else. So I can't think of a better political winner than something like that.
On the other hand, Linda, there were some objections.
Well, it's a use of the federal power of the purse to achieve a social goal that, that has upset some folks. And I think that it's not the first time this has happened. The hospitals were integrated when Medicare, Medicaid legislation passed and the federal government, it said in the legislation that only integrated hospitals get this funding. It didn't take very long.
During
the Johnson administration. But there's some interesting things here. It's a stipulation that the patient can make any designation they want to about who makes decisions for them. And it doesn't necessarily imply a gay and lesbian relationship. It could be, I hate my mother, let my sister do it. Or it could be, I want my college roommate to make the decisions for me. It could be anything. And that represents a change as well.
And as you said, Byron, pretty much all hospitals are affected.
Almost all hospitals in the country accept Medicaid and Medicare patients and payments, so they have to abide by this.
Byron York, The Washington Examiner. Linda Wertheimer, she's senior national correspondent for NPR. E.J. Dionne, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a Washington Post columnist. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The president also this week signed a bill to extend jobless benefits, and this went pretty much on partisan lines, Linda.
That's right, but it didn't take very long to do. I mean, this time the holds that were placed on the legislation before the recess by Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, you know, none of that happened, and the bill went through, and the president signed it instantly, so it went right into law. But it is it offers retroactivity for those people who missed payments. They can go back and get them. So it is, it just sort of things are going along basically in the normal sort of way. I mean, I can't imagine anything more normal than the Congress extending jobless benefits.
Until we've all seen June 2nd.
Right. We've all seen it done dozens and dozens of times in situations far less dire than this.
Byron.
Well, this has been a fight over what is meant by the Democratic commitment to PAYGO. That is, to anytime you extend or expand government spending, that you cut it in some other place. You make up for it, or you raise taxes to make up for it. And Republicans have tried, first in the Jim Bunning affair and now with Tom Coburn, have tried to keep Democrats to their pledge on this. And Democrats have said, no, this is an emergency. We don't have to abide by that now. So, you know, they have 59 votes and they won on a party line vote. I would expect that you'll see Republicans doing this a lot in the future, not just on this issue, but on several others.
Doing what?
Trying to hold Democrats to the PAYGO rules, because there will be certain things that Democrats will deem to be, quote, emergencies, and thus be exempt from the PAYGO rule.
EJ.
It wasn't quite a party line vote, because if it had been a pure party line vote, it wouldn't have gotten through the Senate. You had several Republicans who voted for it, one of whom was Scott Brown of Massachusetts. And I think one of the fascinating things is that ever since he was elected, Scott Brown has cast a number of votes to show his independence from the Republican Party. He also voted for that very small stimulus tax cut earlier this year. This is a man who knew the Tea Party could help him get elected, but probably won't help him get reelected. I don't understand why the
Republican— Which comes in 2 years, by the way.
Right, which is right. Why he's got his eyes on that reelection.
Yeah, not a special.
But not, yes, in I think— I don't understand why the Republicans are doing it. I mean, I understand it in the sense they're trying to make this PAYGO point and they're trying to be fiscally conservative. But first of all, if it's hard to think of a more popular government benefit than unemployment compensation. These are people who've worked really hard and are out of work through no fault of their own. Secondly, the whole point of benefits like unemployment is to do deficit spending in a time of a great downturn. The whole idea is, yes, in a period where we are in a mess, we have the government spend money to pull us out of the recession. So I think that it made no sense what they were arguing on economic grounds, and I don't think it made a lot of sense on political grounds. I think Democrats are very happy to have this fight.
I would agree in the sense that, you know, in the stimulus debate of last year, the one thing that both parties agreed on sticking in the stimulus bill was a lot of unemployment benefits. They felt that the Democrats had thrown tons of pork into it, but they both agreed on unemployment benefits. I don't know why they've chosen to press their case on this particular bill.
It's not clear to me that they have chosen to collectively press their case on this particular bill. I think that Mr. Coburn kind of stepped out in front, and that, you know, he sees much more pure in his view on this, and I think a lot of Middle Western Rust Belt Republicans would have been.
But I think the argument was, if this is something that almost everybody agrees on, extending unemployment benefits, and it costs some money, and we can't agree to counter that with any sort of other spending or taxes, what will we do with issues that are less widely supported in the future? Are we really going to raise taxes or cut other spending to do that? So I think that both Coburn and Bunning were trying to make an actual point with that.
Except Republicans always say, how could you possibly raise taxes in the middle of a deep recession? And that same argument applies to why cut basic government benefits and offset them in the middle of a recession. And it was correct me if I'm wrong, but most Republicans actually did end up voting against this. Is that right?
Because right, it's 38 votes.
Yeah,
against.
So you had a majority of Republicans voting against it. I'm not sure it's a huge deal, but I do know that Democrats who are trying to make this, they are the party of no argument, felt that if they have a place where they can go after the Republicans on that, this is the kind of issue where they can win.
All right, EJ, let's talk about this Florida House race. where Ted Deutch won Tuesday's special election. He's a Democrat. Tell us about that.
Well, I ran into a longtime Democratic activist last night and said, if we had lost that one, then nothing in the country is safe this year. I mean, that's a very safe Democratic seat. If the Democrats had lost, it would have been very, very big news. It would have been, in some ways, probably even more amazing than what happened in Massachusetts with Scott Brown. On the other hand, Democrats are very grateful that they did avoid this catastrophe.
But was it referendum on health care, or was it simply that kind of a safe district?
It was a referendum on health care among the Democratic base, and the Democratic base is happy that health care passed. And it's, you know, it would have been a catastrophe if they had lost it. They didn't, so they're happy.
You look at where they are. I mean, Boca Raton, it's just north of Palm Beach. It's a relatively well-off area, but it's always been very, very Democratic. This is also the epicenter of Madoff in Florida. I mean, Palm Beach and Boca Raton is one of the feeds into that country club that Mr. Madoff, where Mr. Madoff impoverished a number of otherwise very wealthy people. I think that there's just a lot of feeling among the Democrats, even Democrats who have the kind of money that might encourage them to wander, that this is, they're not wandering this year.
Linda Wertheimer of NPR, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, Byron York of The Washington Examiner. Short break, then we'll talk more, and we'll talk especially about strict immigration curbs out in Arizona. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Domestic Hour of our Friday News Roundup with Byron York, Linda Wertheimer, and DJ Dionne. We had a new poll this week, a New York Times CBS poll, gives us perhaps a clearer picture of who supports the Tea Party movement. Byron, tell us about that.
Well, I think they're pretty happy with it, the Tea Party leaders, in the sense that I think it shows Tea Party supporters to be basically within the hash marks of American politics. They're just kind of in the mainstream. I actually covered the Tea Party demonstration here in Washington yesterday, and all of the events that I've covered with them have confirmed basically what this poll says, which says basically I think they're about 18%. The Times found about 18% of the country considers themselves supporters of the Tea Parties. They're mostly Republicans. They're a little older. They're white. They share the economic anxieties of the rest of the country. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They're afraid of losing their health insurance in some cases. So they are a remarkably sort of normal slice of the American political spectrum.
EJ.
I think what this poll shows is that these are right-wing Republicans. They are good old garden variety right-wing Republicans. They are older. They're more male. They are white. they are relatively affluent. If these guys are populists, they are a very well-educated, well-heeled populist, which I think gives a lie to the notion that this is a populist movement. And to me, it raises it. Also, they are, you know, Byron said mainstream, and I guess it's all in the eye of the beholder. I see this poll showing them well to the right of the American mainstream. One question in the poll: do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea to raise income taxes on households that make more than $250,000 a year? 54% of all of us say yes. Only 17% of the Tea Partiers say yes. They are more opposed to government action in all areas. They are something we've had in America forever, which is a strong anti-government right. Now, does that mean they don't? Of course, they deserve press coverage like everyone else. But I think the media have just blown this up into something brand new when it is, in fact, just very conservative Republicans who would never vote Democratic. The only political significance, I think, is that the right is more mobilized right now than the left. So the Republicans are more mobilized than the Democrats. But we knew that, and the Democrats have a lot of work to do. But I think this should give people in the media pause in trying to invent this group as some brand new thing. It's just new anger because Democrats are in power.
Somebody that is rising up. They don't appear to be an uprising, judging from this poll. I thought that the most interesting thing about them was the sort of common or garden variety thing, that they are comfortable. They're financially comfortable. They don't. They appear to be doing very well, and they all say that they feel fine about their personal incomes. Their personal economy is working, and the fact that they're mostly male and almost all white also, you know, tells you something. Now, I thought in the very beginning of this that that what we might be looking at was had a racial component, that these were a group of people that were, you know, just completely undone by the notion that all of a sudden the United States had a black president. But looking at the poll, I think I'm wrong about that. I think that what we're looking at, as EJ says, is a group of people that we've known about for a very long time, who've always been there, who represent a very conservative view of government. And they rise up whenever activist government is in charge, which is the case now.
See, I think you were right in the first place. Actually, this poll does show a racial component. It doesn't show everything is race. It doesn't explain all opposition to Obama. Very interesting question. In recent years, do you think too much has been made of the problems facing black people? Too little has been made, or is it about right? 28% of all Americans say too much. 52% of the Tea Partiers say too much. Again, that doesn't prove that I'm not saying these are all racists or anything like that. But I think we have to face up to the fact that in the set of reasons, at a moment when we seem to be rediscovering nullification and states' rights and Confederate veterans, there is a racial component to this. It's not all of it, but it's an important piece.
I think the polls have shown that a surprisingly large number of the general American public is relatively happy with the amount of money they make. And people who are real strivers are sometimes surprised about that, but it's not that big a surprise. As far as paying attention to the Tea Party movement, we are in what appears to be the process of a wave election happening. A lot of political commentators expect a lot of seats in the House, for example, to change hands. Many people see that if current trends continue, that the Democrats would lose control of the House. I think the press looks at the Tea Party as kind of the tip of the spear, the leading edge, or whatever, of this discontent that is clearly far larger than any Tea Party demonstration.
But the discontent I find surprisingly fragmented in that the Tea Partiers accept Medicare, they accept Social Security, and they seem quite happy with that portion of government, but want to make sure that they're not taxed too high. Well, Social Security and Medicare are a portion of those taxes.
But you can have an intellectually coherent position that accepts Medicare, accepts Social Security, and does not like the Reid-Pelosi bill that passed a few weeks ago. It's not crazy. It, just because you accept the existence of Medicare and Social Security does not mean, therefore, you have to support that bill. And they didn't.
It's also an intellectually coherent position to say, I'm rich, I want what I have from the government, and I don't want other people to have anything more. And that appears to be where a lot of these people are. And, you know, they can defend it.
So you're saying it's a movement of the rich?
What?
You're saying it's a movement of the rich?
Well, the New York Times poll, I'm not saying it's all rich, but the New York Times poll shows that, if anything, the Tea Partiers are more affluent and better educated than the American public as a whole, and that the policies they endorse are policies that would suggest what I just said. I think that when I talked about the attention they receive, if you think that the Tea Party is mainstream, then you think the whole country has gone libertarian in that complete anti-government sense, except for Social Security and Medicare. We haven't. This poll is full of areas where the country is in the middle or even slightly left of middle. And I think that if you're talking about what's going to drive this election, it's not Tea Partiers who are going to vote Republican anyway, except, as I say, for their turnout. It's independents and young people who have where Obama has lost some ground. And that's where Democrats are either going to have to gain back mm-hmm. what they used to have mm-hmm. or they're going to lose the election. The Tea Partiers, I think, are a false flag that will deceive Democrats if they think they can get these votes, and I think will push Republicans farther right than they want to be in the long run.
That's an interesting element. Whether this does cause Republicans to look again at where their party is, and it to some extent it could bolster the Democratic argument that this is the party of no, and this is the party that doesn't want to change anything.
Republicans on Capitol Hill are thinking very, very carefully about this. All the members of the House have been advised to deal with their local Tea Party leaders and to give them some space, to not assume that they're going to vote Republican, even though almost all of them are going to vote Republican. You'll hear a lot of anti-Republican rhetoric at Tea Party rallies. Yesterday, a woman told me, look, I've said it a million times, George Bush opened the door for Obama and the Democrats to do what they do. That's a common sentiment among Tea Partiers. And Republicans are kind of realize that these people could be a very potent force for them come November, but they cherish their independence even if they are going to vote Republican. So Republicans are really trying to come up with a diplomacy to deal with Tea Party supporters.
It's an interesting question.
On EJ's point that the Tea Party movement is getting so much press and so much play, this poll indicates they are but 18% of the population. Do you believe, as EJ says, that what they're saying is becoming inflated? It is they who are saying the Democrats are going to lose many seats.
Well, it's really a lot of fun to go to one of those rallies and read all the signs, the sort of nutty things that people are putting up on banners and listen to the commentaries. And when Sarah Palin makes a speech that says, you know, tell the government, keep the change, it's just, you know, it's irresistible stuff. I think that it is significant in the sense that in any election in a midterm, when you don't have some giant, you know, leadership thing going on like you have with the presidential election, that odd things will happen, and small groups of people can affect change. Now, what the Democrats may be able to do is wake up some of the Obama supporters and say, look, you know, protect what you gained. Protect the president's possibilities, but don't let this happen.
18% is a big number. I mean, yeah. What did Ross Perot get in? Was it
19%?
It was 19, mm-hmm. and we paid a lot of attention to that.
Sure.
So that's a big number.
But he was actually a third-party movement. What we're doing is paying a lot of attention to a faction of the Republican Party. You're right that some of these folks do blame George Bush for opening the way to Obama, but their view of Bush in this survey is much more favorable than the view of other Americans. I think where we might agree is this isn't the Perot movement. The Perot movement was a movement of the center and maybe the center right. It was a much more diffuse kind of protest. It had other elements like anti-free trade. This is a much more conventional conservative movement, which is why, as Byron said, Republicans are engaging in careful diplomacy. They don't want to be tarred with the worst of it, but they sure want their votes.
All right, let's talk about Arizona, whose governor is moving ahead with one of the nation's most strict laws against illegal immigration, what would the law do, EJ?
Well, this law, it's one of the most stringent laws of this sort in the country. It would give the police, in the state police, the power to check the legal status of people they reasonably suspect are illegal immigrants. And I think the passage of this law shows why this immigration issue is so difficult. Arizona is sort of ground zero in some ways of our immigration fight. On the one side, there are a lot of businesses in Arizona that say, look, we'd have a lot of trouble if we didn't have immigrants, and they are in favor of trying to figure out how to legalize the status of immigrants and have some kind of immigration reform. A lot of people in Arizona, particularly supporters of J.D. Hayworth, who's running against John McCain, are very frustrated with the number of illegal immigrants who have crossed into Arizona, and they are demanding laws just like this. It was a little bit of a slap at Janet Napolitano, who actually tried really hard to deal with this issue. I think it's an unfair slap, but it's just a toughening in an election year. And it shows the cross currents on immigration reform that make it so hard to get a bill.
Why is it a slap against Napolitano?
Well, Republicans down there said she hadn't done enough as governor. In fact, she was quite popular. She built a fairly broad support for what she was trying to do on illegal immigration, which was to crack down on illegal immigration at the border. But she also favors some way of ending the problem by creating paths to legalization.
E.J. Dionne at the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Byron, you want to add to that?
Well, Arizona is kind of ground zero. I believe more people enter the United States illegally and through Arizona than any other place. There's a lot of violence south of the border in Mexico. The Arizonans believe some of that violence. It was a murder of a rancher a couple of weeks ago. There was a huge event out there. So this is something that is enormous. And also the federal government has not dealt with the issue in ways that they find satisfactory. So the states are having to come up with their own particular policies. And still remaining, a lot of people continue to favor having a fence. I mean, we would not dream of allowing people to come into the United States through our airports or our seaports with no questions asked. And yet there's a large stream. It's certainly slowed because of the economic slowdown. But there's a large stream that comes across completely illegally.
We may actually right now, or at least up to now, have had a net flow of illegal immigrants back Mexico and elsewhere because of the economic downturn. I mean, they do come here for jobs, and when the jobs disappear, a lot of them go home.
I'm sure that's recent and temporary.
Yeah, we all hope the jobs will reappear, so it's going to be a problem again.
We've had a number of callers asking each of you to name the person you believe speaks for the Republican Party. I'll start with you, Byron.
I do not believe there is such a single person. Absolutely not. I don't think Mitch McConnell does. I don't think Boehner does. I don't think any of the talk show hosts or people outside. It's a party without an obvious leader like a president right now.
Well, I'd say, not Rush Limbaugh, surely. not John Boehner. But I do think Mitch McConnell. I mean, I think absent anybody else, I think Mitch McConnell is right out there. And he's calling it, and he's calling his sort of generally expressed notion is that the president should be seen to fail.
EJ.
Mitch McConnell may be the most important person here, speaking for the Republican Party, but I'm not sure most Republicans, I suspect the polling would show a lot of Republicans don't recognize his name. And I think that one of the reasons Sarah Palin has stepped into this void, and I don't think she speaks for the Republican Party. I don't think she could win the Republican Party nomination, in fact, from looking at a lot of numbers. But one of the reasons she gets the attention is because there's no one who can claim the mantle of either the front runner in the next election or the spokesman for the Republican Party. It also means Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh get a lot more attention.
But it's good. And John McCain has stepped back from that, from that position.
Because he's running so hard at home.
And in Arizona, of course.
There's so many Republicans he's not popular with. I talked with a very high-ranking Republican last night, and we were talking about 2012. And this person believes absolutely that someone is going to appear, that we you're not really considering right now. So I said, no Romney, no Huckabee, no Palin, no Pawlenty. Absolutely not. So there is this, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but there is this belief among Republicans that whoever the next national leader is, they probably know who he or she is right now, but they don't know who that's going to be.
Well, there's a lot of talk among Republicans here, certainly, and in some other parts of the country, of Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana. Republicans are desperately looking for someone who is disconnected enough from the past and disconnected from Washington. Mitt Romney would like to be that person, but he ran the last time. I don't know if Daniels can make it or not, but my sense is there's an awful lot of interest among political types in his potential candidacy.
There are the young Republicans, you know, the younger members of the House, like Mr. Cantor of Virginia, Mr. Ryan of Wisconsin, who are both very attractive. They're very conservative. I think Paul Ryan is probably the most attractive young Republican that I can think of, but he's, I think, way too conservative to get the nomination.
Linda Wertheimer of NPR. After a short break, we'll come back and open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news about politics, culture, and lifestyle at Germany.info. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. A new UN report on the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, China's economy grows by double digits, and Michelle Obama pays an unannounced visit to Haiti. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our domestic Friday News Roundup with E.J. Dionne at the Washington Post, Linda Wertheimer of NPR, Byron York of the Washington Examiner. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diana. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
My comment is just, I'd just like to comment on what EJ had referred to initially during the discussion on the Tea Party movement and, you know, consequently the Tea Party get-togethers. I was at the Raleigh, North Carolina Tea Party get-together yesterday, and I'm a white male in my early 40s making under $80,000 a year. So I'm certainly not a rich person, but it's unfortunate that casual observer, when you hear comments by what we consider left-leaning reporters, journalists, what have you, that are referring to the right way, they are all a bunch of right-wingers, they're a bunch of teabaggers, or any other moniker that kind of just puts them in this box as a wingnut, for lack of a better term. It's so unfortunate because that is so not what the majority is. As somebody who's been to several of these Tea Party movements here in North Carolina, that the we need bipartisanship in the truest sense in this country. And there is going to be no bipartisanship. There's no desire from anybody who is conservative to adhere or to listen to the left, when as long as everybody puts each other in this box. And the fact of the matter is that this is not right-wingers. There are some conservatives, and there's a lot of conservatives, because I'm a registered independent and a fiscal conservative, which means nobody represents me, all right? But the fact that the mainstream media, when I say mainstream, ABC, NBC, CBS, and, you know, on the right side does it about the left wing as well.
All right. Okay. EJ.
Well, 2 points, or 3 points, I guess. One is, when I say right-winger, I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that as what I think is a description of fact. On the right end of the American political spectrum, heck, I can honestly say some of my best friends are right-wingers. But if you look at this survey, the folks in the Tea Party are much more likely to call themselves very conservative, and they are much more likely to take extremely conservative positions within our framework. That seems to me to put them on the right end of the spectrum. That doesn't make them fascists, or I never use that word because it's always, almost always wrong. They're more, you know, very conservative or right-wing libertarians. And in terms of affluence, of course, everybody in the Tea Party isn't rich. What we were talking about is, or what I was talking about anyway, was the finding in the New York Times poll that, contrary to the impression created about a kind of mass sort of almost working class populist movement, these are more affluent people than the country as a whole. And the survey also found that fewer of them than other Americans are more likely to describe themselves as working class.
Well, so, the ones that I've met at these events follow pretty much exactly what the caller said. A lot of people yesterday were talking about the information we have recently, which is not terribly new, which is that 47% of American taxpayers do not pay any income tax. They pay Social Security tax, Medicare, but they don't pay any income tax. And clearly the people of the Tea Party consider themselves, the ones I have met, are certainly not in the 1%, top 1% or 2% or 5% of the American income spectrum. They feel themselves solidly middle class, and that they are paying these taxes, which they are, and that too many Americans don't pay any taxes. Now,
but
this is something
many
Republicans...
many of that group is below the income needed to pay income tax, and in fact are getting these income tax credits. I think you have to break down.
Well, if they're so rich, they've got to be paying income tax. I mean,
no,
you and EJ can discuss that part.
Obviously, you have to break down that 47% to understand who are the wealthy who are not paying income tax and who are the very low income who are not paying income tax. But I'm going to read you an email we've just received from St. Louis. It's from Pat, who says, I really don't think your guests have a grip on what's going on in this country. Talk of revolution is as commonplace as it seems. It is not only among fringe far right wingers. It happens where I work daily. Talk of an eventual violent overthrow of the federal government happens daily as water cooler talk. People are truly taken aback by Obama and his extremism. All the emails we are getting this morning are about the Tea Party movement. EJ.
18% of Americans can produce a lot of emails. 18% of Americans is a lot of people. They just don't happen to be a majority or anything close to a majority. There is some extreme rhetoric out there that I think is very troubling, and I think Republicans ought to speak up against it. I wrote a column about the gentleman who flew that plane into that building where the IRS was housed, killing an IRS worker. I did not think there was a strong enough reaction to say, this is wrong. There was, yes, people said it was wrong, but then it kind of disappeared from view. Now, I don't think, in deference to the earlier caller, that most people on the right are using rhetoric about revolution. But for example, I don't remember any other president who had who gave a speech and had people carrying guns to the event. I think this is an awful thing, and that we should talk about it, and Republicans should talk about it, because in the short run, they may be benefiting from this energy. But in the long run, it's just not going to be good for them or for the country.
Is anybody in the Republican Party, as far as all of you are concerned, standing up and saying, in reaction to some of this extreme rhetoric, knock it off? Linda?
I'm sure they are, I wish that I could call, I wish that I could name some people. I tend to think that this whole message, this kind of message, is somewhat blunted by the Republican leadership in the Congress wanting to maintain such a completely down-the-line loyalist position so that people who are not on the line would not feel comfortable with it. I think that Republican governors around the country during the, during this first year of President Obama's administration have said several times, Governor Schwarzenegger was one, who talked about how these are things we need, there are things we need that the states need, and we are going to have to find some way of handling our problems, and it is going to involve the federal government. There's been a little, I think at the state governorship level, you're dealing with people who have to deal with their people and who have to do things that have to solve problems, have to balance budgets, have to fix programs.
I think there's always a tense relationship between political leaders and the extremes of their own parties. I think in the Bush years, you saw this. I listened to prominent college professors tell me how they thought Bush would cancel the election in 2008 and remain in office. I attended the premiere of Fahrenheit 9/11 in Washington, where almost the entire Democratic political leadership showed up for it. So you have to, each party has to have this relationship between the elected leadership and the most committed, if you will, or the most extreme people in their own party. And that's what you see with Republican leaderships and some of the ones on the extreme, although I still believe most of the Tea Partiers are in what you would call the political mainstream of the country.
You had intense opposition to President Bush. What you didn't have is talk of violence. What you didn't have bringing guns to events.
There was a movie called The Assassination of the President that was featured in some Newsweekly magazines. I believe it won an award. There was a lot of talk. As a matter of fact, I think, I'm trying to remember. I shouldn't say. It was a New York politician who talked about giving Bush one between the eyes. And there was a fair amount of
talk
about this.
But I don't think it was
very intense.
We should go to an anti-war
rally.
Somebody should do empirical work on this. One of us is right, one of us is wrong. I do not in any way recall the use of violence. The man who had the sign saying the tree of liberty must be watered by the blood of tyrants, this kind of thing produced over and over again. I really do think there is something different, and I hope somebody out there is doing the research, and then we can settle this. But I think it's much more violent.
The anniversary of Oklahoma City is this week, and I think that there have been a lot of things written about that, perhaps that sprang out of a period of upset by one side against a government that had very different ideas about
how to operate. Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Mark, thanks for waiting. Mark, are you there? He's not. Let's go to Abraham in Orlando, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'll make it as quick as possible. The Tea Party, let's call it for what it is. It's part of the Republican Party, okay? They are not going to vote for any Democratic candidates. And the other thing also is, whenever there's a Democratic president, it seems to me that we have militias coming out, and I don't think it's a coincidence. And also the other day, I saw Sarah Palin talking about 47% of people not paying taxes. Well, part of that is because it was a Republican president who gave $1,000 to parents as a tax deduction to raise their kids. Now, maybe in Sarah Palin's world, that is a bad thing. We hear about this 47% not paying taxes. What about all the huge corporations that are not paying enough taxes?
Fair point. Or not, Byron.
Well, what can I say? I mean, I believe I said earlier that Republican and Democratic presidents have pushed taxes lower. I think Republicans are very big on this idea of the strangely named tax credits, where they actually give you money instead of you paying taxes. So, Tea Partiers are upset about this 47% number, and we're talking again about income taxes, not all taxes. And I think it's a reasonable question to ask, how high is the 47% number going to get? Is it going to go even higher? Do you support that or not support that? I think those are real questions.
First of all, if the caller is absolutely right, by the way. It's very important. This credit that Bush signed, which I think is a good idea, it's pro-family, actually increased the number of people who didn't have to pay income tax. And as I recall, President Bush bragged about it, and I would have too. Secondly, this 47% number is a very deceptive number. David Leonhardt had an excellent piece in the New York Times that everybody should read.
He was on his program last week.
And it's 47% who don't pay income tax. Just about everybody who works pays the payroll tax, which is a regressive tax. It only hits part of your income. The wealthy do not pay the payroll tax on most of their income. Everybody who is in a state that has a sales tax pays a sales tax. It is nonsense to say that 40 to give Byron credit, he did say it's the income tax. But then people jump quickly to say 47% of the people don't pay taxes. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And I was really glad David wrote that piece to make that clear.
All right. We'll go back to the phones after I remind you you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Mobile, Alabama. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Since none of the guys on the liberal side will say this, let me say this from the conservative side. I have been a Republican for four or five generations in the South, which is rare. However, I have a mind, and I try to use it. And if this movement is about physical conservatism, which I've been a member of the physical conservative wing of the Republican Party, I think there's about six of us left. We need a phone book. Then why haven't they said anything for the last 8 years as we've basically taken what was a budget, when they turned the budget clock off, almost a neutral budget, and gone completely crazy? What this is really about, in my opinion, is latent racism. I'll say it from the right wing side, and also it's a principle that they have to pay for insurance, and they think someone else is going to get it free. This is a continuation of the damn baby boomers, the looking out for number one, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's just about being selfish.
All right, Byron, selfishness.
What can I say to that? I have to say, I confess, I drifted off for a moment while he was discussing the fact of racism in this Tea Party, and the fact if you had a president, it's not a huge thought experiment to imagine another president being elected and doing the things that Obama has done. There would be significant opposition to him, would there not? I mean, I think you can argue that Democrats misread the results of the 2008 election. You had people being absolutely sick of George Bush and the Republicans electing Democrats in 2006 and then again in 2008, more as a process of unelecting and punishing Republicans than of deciding that they wanted the entire Obama agenda to be enacted. And then when the president does what he says he's going to do and does it quickly on a lot of fronts, they start saying, whoa, 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 slow down. So I think that's entirely possible without any race being a factor.
You could, I suppose, make the argument that America was not prepared for Ronald Reagan. They were just trying to get rid of Jimmy Carter. I think that one of the most interesting things that this caller brought up, and something that I wonder about all the time, and that is that the American economy was very badly damaged by the policies of the Bush administration, and the American deficits were vastly increased by the war policies of the Bush administration, and it isn't clear to, you know, to any of us now how any of those wars can be sort of turned around, made to work. Are they winnable? I mean, there are all kinds of awful discussions going on now about the investment in blood and treasure that the United States has made and whether it means anything.
This last email from Ian in Baltimore, who says, I wonder how Mr. York felt about the PAYGO rules when President Bush, between his tax cut, his unnecessary war, and his Medicare benefit, added $3 trillion to the national debt. Where were the fiscally responsible Republicans?
Well, there was actually a tech bubble that also happened early in that time to add to the deficit.
So we have talked lots about the Tea Party. We haven't gotten to a lot of other things we should have. But thank you all for being here for this week's Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.